Hello, welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. I almost call myself Miranda Cruz. I was talking to my sister earlier. I guess I miss her. I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up on the show today, a fired Seattle Times columnist says he was naive to believe that the city of Seattle would be a tolerant place to work. He's now telling his story about why he was fired in an article for the Free Press. We'll dive into it. Plus, no one is letting journalism die. I keep hearing and reading these stories in traditional media about we can't let journalism die. It'll be the end of our democracy. But in truth, no one's letting journalism die. Journalism is slowly killing itself. We'll talk about it. Also, an unbelievable roundtable on the fentanyl crisis, where a simple question was asked, why is Washington State ground zero for the fentanyl crisis? And it seemed that no one could possibly muster a common sense answer. All of that and more. But first, if you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, please do so. It's how we continue to do this show full time. You can sign up at UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com is just $5 a month, $5 a month. Think of all the things you could buy for $5. Saving the state of Washington and restoring sanity, small price to pay. All right, let's start with this. First of all, let me be very clear, not that I could be canceled, but I don't like Nazi comparisons. I just generally don't. And there's been a lot of them that have been high profile. I don't care if they're coming from the left or from the right. I just don't like Nazi comparisons because they're very lazy. The Hitler comparisons, I just feel like it's a cheap way for people to make their point about something. I mean, how many times has, Trump supporters been called Nazis? I mean, I've been called a Nazi a million times on social media. I just think they're lazy. So generally speaking, I don't like them. But there was a brand new Seattle Times columnist who got fired from his job after just 2 months, after his very first op-ed, in part because of a Hitler-Nazi comparison that he made. And he's telling his story today in the Free Press, which is the independent news source from Barry Weiss. Highly recommend you read the article. And I want to go through the sequence of events and we'll read his story from his perspective. The story, again, in the Free Press is headlined, "My family was hunted by Nazis, but I was fired for defending Hitler." It was written by David Velodsko, who again was had a very brief stint as an op-ed writer for the Seattle Times. In the article, he writes, "I was just fired from my job at the Seattle Times after defending Hitler. The only problem is I never defended Hitler," and I'll read from it here. "In fact, my family was hunted by the Nazis. My grandfather was a Nazi killer who later almost died in a concentration camp, and some of my best journalistic work has been exposing neo-Nazi lies. But if you want to hear a story about the intolerance in our country's, quote, most tolerant city and the erosion of civil discourse in American life, read on." Well, yes, sir, I do want to hear a story about intolerance in our country's most tolerant city and the erosion of civil discourse in American life. So I did read on. But to set this all up, so again, David was a brand new, opinion writer for the Seattle Times. And he says in this story that he wanted to write about something else entirely. And he ends up being told to or assigned to write an article about the infamous Lenin statue that's in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood. So it's a long background of how it got there, but essentially in the heart of the Fremont neighborhood, there is this giant statue of the Russian communist murderous dictator Vladimir Lenin. And every so often, the issue of this statue comes up about, why is it here? Should we let it stay here? Should we take it down? What should we do with it? So he ends up writing his first op-ed for the Times, the headline, "Dear Fremont, we need to talk about Lenin and your statue of the genocidal tyrant." And he doesn't argue in the article that it should be removed or make any opinion about what its, ultimate fate should be. But the takeaway of the article is, look, people go and they see this statue and they'll paint its hands red and they'll dress it up on the holidays, put a pumpkin on its head and stuff. He said, maybe we should reconsider how we treat this statue and instead of making a joke out of it or making a spectacle out of it, considering Lenin killed millions and millions of people. So he writes this article. And as with any opinion piece, it gets mixed reviews. Some people like it, some people don't. But then he takes to Twitter to talk about it a little further. And it seems that this is where his mistake was. And it was on Twitter where he started to draw comparisons between Hitler and Lenin. So he tweets out in part, In fact, while Hitler has become the great symbol of evil in history books, he too was less evil than Lenin because Hitler only targeted people he personally believed were harmful to society, whereas Lenin targeted even those he himself did not believe were harmful in any way. So there are some activists on Twitter who just lost it over that, absolutely lost it, and started, you know, tweeting at the Times about this writer and, hey, he's trying to downplay what Hitler did, comparing him to Lenin, whatever, the usual stuff. So in this article, again, published this morning in the Free Press, David explains what he was intending to do with that comparison on Twitter. He writes, "I was only speaking in terms of intention, of who wanted to kill more, not who actually did." And in a follow-up tweet, I explained, quote, "Hitler was more evil than Lenin if we're looking at what they did to people." And that's a pretty important metric for assessing evil. So he goes on to say, 6 days after my piece was published, I was relieved when my boss told me she had reviewed the Twitter conversation and concluded I had obviously not defended Hitler, because that's what all the activists on Twitter were saying, all the far-left bloggers who just hate the Times op-ed board anyway. He goes on to say, I was told the company had my back. I was told the paper would not stand for a lying Twitter mob coming after one of its own. Okay, and that sounds pretty promising, like, great. Seattle Times is going to stand by this guy whose family was literally hunted by the Nazis and say, no, we're not going to buy into these nonsensical accusations that he's now defending the very people who hunted down and killed his family. So, and then he gives the caveat. So he's told, again, 6 days after the piece published, he's going to keep his job, family's going to have his back, they're not going to bend to a Twitter mob. Except, he says, just a few hours later, my boss called me and told me I was fired. The official reason for firing me was, quote, poor judgment and, quote, continuing to engage online. They said I shouldn't have engaged. He says, I admit it was hard not to defend my family against the baseless accusations they were Nazis who had killed more than 10,000 Jews. So here you've got this writer, brand new to Seattle, is assigned to do an op-ed on something he doesn't even want to do an op-ed on, the Lenin statue in Fremont. Someone whose family was hunted by the Nazis. He makes the mistake on Twitter of doing a Hitler comparison, doing a Nazi comparison, comparing one genocidal maniac to another. People come after him, and the Seattle Times bends to the mob, as so many media outlets do. So the Times released a statement about this saying, a Seattle Times editorial writer engaged in Twitter recently in a way, that is inconsistent with our company's values and those of our family ownership. Effective immediately, he is no longer employed by the Seattle Times. While we passionately believe in creating lively discourse through a variety of viewpoints, we do so with respect and appreciation for all communities. We apologize for any pain we have caused our readers, our employees, and the community. So basically, it sounds like the family that owns the Times is like, no, you got to fire him. And that's the danger, right, of not being an independent journalist, is you can be fired at the whim of the people that you work for reasons that are ridiculous. So again, to sum up the absurdity of this, 2 months on the job, first op-ed, an assignment he was given. This guy ends up being painted as like pro-Hitler, even though his family was hunted by the Nazis. The Seattle Times promises to stand behind him, says they're not going to bend to a lying Twitter mob. And then what do they do a few hours later? They bend to a lying Twitter mob. And one of the things I think that made me feel most bad for this writer is he was talking about how he was excited to live and work in Seattle. How, you know, he brought his family here, and there's so many aspects to this supposedly inclusive, tolerant city that he really was looking forward to. And he writes in the piece, the job was rewarding. From the first day, I found myself reporting on the protection of orcas and efforts to improve the level of civil discourse in Congress. When Pride Month came, my family proudly marched with the Seattle Times. What a beautiful new home, I thought to myself. How inclusive, how tolerant, how naive. How naive indeed. Again, I encourage that you read that full article at the Free Press, but I think it is so indicative of this point that we've come to where, you know, and I'll use again Nazi comparisons as an example. You know how many far-left bloggers in Seattle, like Erica Barnett, who have compared Trump supporters to Nazis? I remember a tweet in particular where she was talking about, you know, all the Nazis that attended a speech of former President Donald Trump's. And essentially, again, you're talking about a homicidal dictator and his army that kill millions of innocent people. And it's okay for far-left bloggers to compare a president, a modern-day president, and his supporters to Nazis, to Hitler. But it's not okay for a Seattle Times columnist whose family was hunted down by the Nazis to talk about Lenin and Hitler and the comparisons and contrast between the two of them, because we live in a society right now where there's absolutely no room for nuance, number one, because there was a lot of nuance in the argument that this writer was making. But we also live in a society where the left, the far left, as far as the media is concerned, can get away with a lot more. Can absolutely get away with a lot more. If you're comparing someone who's on the right to Nazis, then that's just, oh, that's great, that's great. No big deal. And it's this double standard. But it all, I think, just speaks to the erosion of our ability to have a reasonable conversation. And I couldn't help but kind of laugh at, around the same time, another columnist who posted in the Seattle Times did this piece kind of waxing poetically about the downfall of journalism. And in the piece, he talks about how, you know, trust for journalism and corporate media is at an all-time low. And it doesn't have to be this way. And first of all, I just reject the narrative that we're all, you know, letting the media die. And that's a danger to democracy. The media is slowly killing itself. And an example is what we just talked about with them firing a columnist for the crime of, you know, not framing a tweet very well. So anyway, in this Other Times op-ed by Marcus Harrison Green, the headline is, "If we let journalism die, our democracy won't be too far behind." And in it, he writes, "I'm not Pollyannish about our media. I know that it can be used for malevolent intent, but too often is. And too often is. But God, I also know it's a force. Its force as a tool to level our society's power differentials, to remind each other that we are not alone and that we do, and that what we do, how we act, and how we conduct our lives in the shared act of living matters. That these problems of complexity we face, whether racial, environmental, political, or economical, will not be solved by simplistic reactions, but by meaningful responses." So I would ask the Seattle Times, which again published that op-ed, are you following that yourselves when Marcus Harrison Green says these problems of complexity we face, whether racial, environmental, political, or economical, will not be solved by simplistic reactions, but by meaningful responses? I would ask the Seattle Times, was your response to the controversy around your brand new columnist, was it a meaningful response? Or was it a simplistic reaction? Was it a simplistic reaction that was based on what the easiest thing to do in the moment would be, to silence the mob? I would argue that it was a very simplistic reaction, that it was not a meaningful response. And that in doing so, you undercut exactly what this column is trying to argue about the best path forward as a country and the best path forward for journalism in this country. Something to think about for the Seattle Times, and I think an awful good starting place would be to apologize to the columnist that you fired for overreacting, for bending to a Twitter mob, and offer him his job back if he wants to take it. All right, coming up next in our segment, Unbelievable, the most unproductive roundtable on the fentanyl crisis that you could possibly imagine. But first, we've been talking about our friends at First Mark Insurance, firstmarkinsurance.com. Mike and I are now members of the First Mark family. We took their First Mark challenge a few months ago. It was really eye-opening for us. It's such an easy process. I recommend everyone do it because it's a no-brainer, and it could end up saving you a lot of money. You know, we spoke to a woman who is now saving $100 a month after doing the First Mark challenge. That's $1,200 a year. Can help you offset some of the high cost of gasoline. Here's Dave Taylor, the CEO of First Mark.
The First Mark Challenge, it's simple from a consumer standpoint, right? It's simple, it's free, it doesn't take very much time, and it's going to help you feel confident about your coverage, one way or another. And you said earlier, low pressure, we are no pressure, right? At the end of the day, when we get done and we look at that spreadsheet, we're going to tell you, you're going to see the facts in front of you. It's going to be real obvious to you what the right decision is. But our job is to make recommendations. It's our client's job to decide. And we're going to support them whichever way they go.
Yeah. And I think one of the best parts is the First Mark Challenge costs you nothing. And the reason I say it's a no-brainer is there's only a few scenarios. You know, Mike and I went into it knowing we were underinsured. So we ended up getting much better insurance for the same price. So no-brainer. Or the team over at First Mark might tell you, hey, you've got great insurance and you're actually getting a good rate. Just keep what you already have. And then you've only wasted a little bit of time and learned a lot in the process. Or they could come and say, hey, we can get you better insurance or insurance that's just as good and we can be saving you a lot of money. So try the First Mark challenge. I think you'll be surprised by how much you'll learn and how much you can save. FirstMarkInsurance.com. FirstMarkInsurance.com. They work for you. There was a round tables in and of themselves. I cringe whenever I hear that word because they're always so unproductive, but this one particularly so, and it had to do with the fentanyl crisis. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. All right, every 6 years, Senator Maria Cantwell emerges from her cocoon in Washington, D.C. and pretends to care about the issues facing Washington State. And of course, we're closing in on her reelection year in 2024. And so she's making herself known more often. And she came to the Seattle area to do a roundtable on the fentanyl crisis, which I think is a great thing. I think everyone should be focused on and talking about ways that we can deal with the fentanyl crisis. She was joined by the mayor of Seattle, the chief of the fire department in Seattle, as well as some families who have personal tragedies to tell, and some members of federal law enforcement, again, to talk about, okay, what's going on here? How can we address it? I have no issue with that, although I think roundtables are stupid because I think it's a lot of politicians who sit in a little semicircle and for the news cameras and discuss whatever their talking points are going to be, and then nothing ever actually gets done. So I think it's dumb, but if you're talking about it, I'd rather you be talking about it than not talking about it at all. But the issue is that the whole point of the roundtable was to sort of figure out, okay, why is the fentanyl crisis worse in Washington State than anywhere else in the country? Our rate of fentanyl overdoses is much higher and is growing much faster than anywhere else in the country. So that's a little legitimate question. Okay, fentanyl is an issue in more places than Washington State, but it is particularly bad here. It's a particularly deadly crisis here. And so during this roundtable, Senator Maria Cantwell asked the group of experts, quote unquote, before her why that was. You know, why is the fentanyl crisis worse here than any other state in the union? And I was going to sit here and play for you all the responses to that question. But I thought I'd just list them for you because, frankly, I don't think we have that much time. Rather than anyone sitting there, again, which was law enforcement, it was first responders, it was politicians, it was families, rather than anyone there stating what the obvious answer to that question is, I want to list for you all the other reasons they gave, which I'm not saying these reasons aren't contributing factors to why the crisis is so bad, but they don't speak to the heart of why the crisis is worse in Washington State than anywhere else. So among the reasons, fentanyl is very cheap in Washington. Washington's position on Interstate 5 makes it a convenient place to traffic drugs. Congress hasn't declared the fentanyl crisis a crisis at all, which would help us get support from federal agencies. So that's making it so bad here. More federal grants are needed for treatment. Medicaid rules don't allow for payment for certain treatment services. What other reasons? Federal regulations on methadone are too tight. There's not enough treatment beds. So here you've got this group of people gathered to discuss the fentanyl crisis, and they are throwing out everything under the sun to explain why the fentanyl crisis is worse in Washington than anywhere else. Not one of them, not one of them offers up the most obvious explanation, which I know all of you are absolutely screaming out loud right now. And that's because we have made sure that there is virtually no consequence for using the drug or trafficking the drug in Washington State. I've said it before. Why would you not traffic a drug like fentanyl in Washington State, where police are all but prohibited from pulling you over? Why would you not use drugs out in the open like fentanyl in Washington State when you're never going to get arrested for it? You're not going to spend a day in jail for it. We have established an environment where there is no fear of consequence. That's why the fentanyl crisis is worse here than any other state in the union. That is the obvious answer. It is the common sense answer, but apparently it is not the politically palatable answer. I mean, think of some of these answers that were thrown out to explain why Washington has the highest rate right now of fentanyl overdoses in terms of its growth. More federal grants are needed for treatment. Okay, well, that's a federal issue. That doesn't just impact Washington State, so that doesn't explain it. Medicaid rules don't allow for payment for certain treatment services. Again, federal issue. That doesn't explain why it's the highest in Washington State. Federal regulations on methadone are too tight. Okay, that's a federal issue. That doesn't explain why Washington State is sitting on its own little death island when it comes to fentanyl. Washington's position on Interstate 5. You know, there are two other states along Interstate 5, Oregon and California, that also have significant drug crises, but they're still not as bad as Washington State. So again, that doesn't answer the simple question. Congress hasn't declared it a crisis, which would help get support from federal agencies. Again, if Congress declared it as a crisis, that would apply to every single state in the union. Since Congress has not declared it a crisis, that also applies to every single state in the union, not just Washington. That does not answer the core question of why it's worse here than anywhere else. There is only one explanation for why it's worse here than anywhere else. It's because we don't care that people use it here. Our politicians don't care that people sell it here. The party in power is busy actively passing and proposing legislation to take it easy on people who do these things, to make life easier on criminals who peddle these deadly drugs to people in our communities. And not a single freaking soul sitting at that table has the courage to muster what is true. And we expect a roundtable like that to solve the issue. How many times have we said on this show, you cannot solve a problem that you refuse to properly identify the cause of? And so all that roundtable did is make me even more certain that if the same people stay in charge in our state, we are going to head down the exact same trajectory. And it is a deadly one. All right, coming up next, we'll dip outside the state. There was a congressional hearing that Nicole had to include because she knew it was right up my alley. It's not uplifting. It's a little concerning, but I like the subject. So we'll talk about that coming up next. But first, we've been talking about our friend Wes Jones, a wonderful real estate agent in our area. If you're in the market to sell your home, sure, check out a few real estate agents, but make sure you check out our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. He and his team have something really cool. It's called the Listing Boost Concierge Service, where they can really help eliminate the stress that goes into selling your home.
So we're going to come in, number one, and we're going to inspect a home, do a pre-inspection. And we're going to find out all those little hidden bugs that, you know, a buyer may be concerned with. And if a seller wants to do some cosmetic updates, you know, whether it's flooring, whether it's lighting, countertops, even a kitchen, we're going to help guide them through that. So the Listing Boost Concierge Service, what we can do is we can project manage those rehab projects. We have a list of contractors and preferred vendors that we like to work with and have a ton of experience with. And we'll take that off a seller's hands. We'll go ahead and run that project for them. And we even have some options where they can pay at closing out of their net proceeds.
Yeah, how cool is that? And again, like the stress of selling a home when you're like, oh my gosh, I want to get the best possible offer for it, but there's so much that needs to be done to it before I put it on the market. Wes Jones and his team can handle all of that for you. They can even help pay for it up front. So it's really, really cool if that's one of the services that might benefit you. If you're going to sell your home, check out sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. Okay, dipping outside of Washington State for a moment, the Hunter Biden plea deal fell apart. Well, that was kind of a surprise. We were sitting here like watching it play out. It happened behind closed doors, but all the reporters were speculating like, what's going on? Why isn't this happening? This is the article from CNBC. Hunter Biden pleads not guilty to charges after judge questions the plea deal. So this has to be on the has to do with the misdemeanor tax charges. So he had gotten like a really sweetheart plea deal, right? And so there was news that, oh, this isn't going to go the way that he thinks it's going to go. I'll read from this CNBC article for folks. It says, Judge Mary Ellen Norica, an appointee of former President Donald Trump, had pressed the prosecutors with questions after they indicated that their investigation into Biden is ongoing. That answer appeared to prompt confusion about the possibility that more charges could be brought down the road, a situation Biden's attorney said they had not agreed to. Norica put the proceedings on hold as she asked the parties to work out their dispute. After 1 p.m. Eastern time, Biden entered a plea of not guilty, pending the approval of a revised plea deal. Noriega said she wants written answers to certain provisions in the new agreement. And I guess that kind of also makes sense for Hunter Biden. I'm sure there were some people on the right just hoping that, oh, his plea deal was going to get taken away and he's going to be sent to prison. I don't think that's the case. But I think it sounds like, okay, from his attorney's standpoint, if there are potentially more charges down the road, if there's an investigation ongoing, why would we agree to a plea deal on this only to possibly have him facing more prison time on something else? Why wouldn't we wait and try to bundle things together or do a different kind of plea deal? So this makes sense from my perspective, from a legal standpoint. So in case people were getting all excited that Hunter Biden, they don't like him, he's going to go spend a lot of time in prison and screwed up his plea deal, that just doesn't seem to be the case. But we will follow that one. Okay, a couple congressional, first of all, I hate congressional hearings. Hate them, despise them, they're worthless. It is just a show and tell. Nobody actually asks questions that are relevant. Nobody asks questions that are designed to elicit responses. They just want to hear themselves talk, and they just want to talk at the witnesses, and it's all so political and such grandstanding. But occasionally, I think there are some interesting back and forths. We'll get to one momentarily. But an example of just how worthless congressional hearings are. So there was a Secretary Mayorkas, of course, of DHS. He is before Congress for a congressional hearing, and that's really important. I mean, how many legitimate, awesome, important questions could you ask Secretary Mayorkas about what's happening at the southern border? And I'll say Representative Daryl Issa asked a really pertinent question. We know that there have been folks on the terror watch list who have been apprehended at the southern border. And Representative Issa wanted to know, well, where are they? Here it is.
By definition, Mr. Secretary, if you're on the terrorist watch list, you represent a threat. So 140 people on the terrorist watch list so far this year. For the record, would you please give us the status of each of those individuals so we know what you did with people who were on a terrorist watch list, who were apprehended, many got away, but were apprehended, where they are today so that Congress can know?
Congressman, I would be pleased to provide you with that information with respect to the individuals encountered at the southwest border.
Thank you. I yield back.
Gentleman yields back, but could the Secretary answer that question? What is the status of those 140?
Mr. Chairman, what authority or point of order?
Congressman Jayapal of Washington interrupting.
Gentlelady, state of point of order.
Mr. Chairman, under what authority are you speaking right now? Whose time? Whose time is it? Are you being recognized for 5 minutes?
I was just asking what I thought would be a question
every single member of Congress would want to know.
I'll do it on my time or someone other time.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
He had asked the question, and there wasn't an answer to the status of the 140
Mr. Chairman,
people
he did,
the
witness provided an answer, and if you want to use
think
your
he did,
5 minutes,
I'll do it on my time.
Great.
That's fine.
Thank
we
you.
Recognize the gentlelady from California.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, so annoying. So the Daryl Issa question was great. Like, we ought to know, and Secretary Mayorkas ought to be able to share that with Congress, the whereabouts of every single person who was apprehended at the southern border who happened to be on a terror watch list. That's a no-brainer. And the thing that bothers me about these hearings is Secretary Mayorkas said, yes, I'll provide that to you. And that was a satisfactory answer for Representative Issa. And I don't think there's anyone with a lick of common sense who expects Secretary Mayorkas to sit there during the hearing and articulate the current location of all 140 people that have been apprehended at the southern border. I don't think anybody expects that to happen during the hearing. And Representative Issa didn't either. He's saying, okay, thank you. And I'm sure that his office plans to follow up and get that information from Secretary Mayorkas. But then you have Jim Jordan and Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal that just got to put on a little spectacle after that. And I'm annoyed with both of them, Republican, Democrat. Jim Jordan interrupts and says, are you going to answer the question? As if he really expects him to sit there and go through all 140 names and locations. Nobody expects that, but he wanted to make a point. He wanted to grandstand. And then you've got Congresswoman Jayapal butting in for no reason on a question that's, you know, that started as a relevant question because she's worried about the point of order. Oh, well, whose time are you speaking on? No, she just didn't want that particular line of questioning to continue because it's kind of embarrassing for Democrats and for the Biden administration to continue to have conversations about how 140 people on the terror watch list have come up illegally into the United States, and those are just the ones we know about. So it's just a perfect example of why I hate congressional hearings. Even when you've got just a glimmer of hope that there might be a pertinent question where we can actually get some really good information, the grandstanding completely ruins it. However, there was another hearing that was wonderful.
And in fact, it's so, okay, Nicole, I talk about aliens a lot. Look, fine. And people know this now. And so now they tag me in these things. Like, did you see this? So now I'm like, that's my beat, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of in on it.
So there was, you're kind of what?
In on it.
Oh, like, you're in on it. Yeah.
Now I'm like, alien story, we have to do it.
Great. Well, this one, it's should be a nonpartisan issue. Undivided.
Give us the dirt.
It's about our survival. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there was this really interesting hearing that involved, and I'm going to butcher his last name, but David Grush. He's a whistleblower that on UAPs that has come out and talked about. He was a former combat officer, a veteran of the Pentagon's intelligence community, said that he received, quote, extensive classified information about deeply covert programs that have to do with the retrieval of intact and partially intact craft of non-human origin. So here's a clip of him, and he's being questioned by Representative Nancy Mace.
If you believe we have crashed craft, stated earlier, do we have the bodies of the pilots who piloted this craft?
As I've stated publicly already in my News Nation interview, biologics came with some of these recoveries, yeah.
Were they, I guess, human or non-human biologics?
Non-human, and that was the assessment of people with direct knowledge on the program I talked to that are currently still on the program.
And was this documentary evidence, this video, photos, eyewitness? Like, how would that be determined?
The specific documentation I would have to talk to you in a skiff about.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, that's really interesting stuff. This is a whistleblower in front of a congressional hearing talking about non-human aircraft and bodies and some stuff he can't even talk about. So come on, we got to mainstream this. Why is it still not a more mainstreamed conversation?
Well, I mean, this is getting a lot of attention. It's probably getting more attention than the border stuff. So that's
yes, it should get more attention.
Well, I guess, but the border stuff's important too. But yes, I think that, well, I mean, this guy is a whistleblower, but he's also, it's like secondhand information, it seems like. So I don't know. It's still a little secondhand. I mean, once you get firsthand, that's what we need.
Well, there have been firsthand accounts of the little tic-tacs from pilots who like saw things they couldn't explain in the air. And I take that back. I don't know that it should get more attention than the border, because the border is an ongoing, like, tangible, we can look at this, and it's actually a threat, like people are dying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the UAP situation is serious. We don't know if they, like, would mean to do us harm, but it's obviously quite significant.
Right.
So that is a congressional hearing that I would spend some time watching.
I have some more videos for you then.
Today or another day?
From that guy.
Right now?
He was up there for a while. No.
Oh,
no,
why would you tease and then not give the people more videos?
I just mean I'll let you watch them for fun.
Oh, okay. I'll watch it. We'll watch it later. This is what I do for fun on my free time. All right, Nicole, thank you. We can talk about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, eastsideweightlossclinic.com. I've spoken to so many of you who have had fantastic results on the program, as I have. I'm down 36 pounds. We ran into Ben and his wife, Leslie, who did the program together, which is such a good way to do it. It would have been so much easier if Mike had done it with me, just because it's like, oh, we're going to do this together. Teamwork. So Ben and Leslie, teamwork makes the dream work. We took a picture together. Combined in 6 months, we were down 101 pounds, which is awesome. So if you've been considering it, a few things about the program. No counting calories, no prepackaged meals, no strenuous workout routine, but also no weird stuff like hypnosis or surgery or anything like that. It really is just teaching you how to eat the right foods in the right portions and how to carry that forth throughout your life, and you don't feel like you're on some long-term diet that just makes everything not fun. So do what I did, what so many others have done. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. They'll explain the program to you. You can decide whether it's something that's right for you. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Okay, let's get to questions and comments from the show today. This on the Seattle Times columnist who was fired. And the reason I'm so passionate about this is I think that the whole rush to judgment, the lack of nuance in our debates, the rush to vilify people who you don't agree with, the high standards that we apply to people who we don't agree with versus the people who we do, I really think it's responsible for so much of what's happening in this country. It's like we only have grace for people who we agree with politically. We don't have grace for anyone else. And I think if we can fix that, we can fix so much of what's wrong in our society right now. Lieutenant Dan said on that story, no problem making a mockery of history's mass murderers. Not a fan of the statue, the Lenin statue. It's private property, and they can do what they want with it. Yeah, and I tend to agree. And the Seattle Times columnist, he didn't offer an opinion on whether the statue could be taken down. He just thought maybe we need to treat it with the seriousness that it deserves. But yeah, I mean, he also talked about, you know, we've demanded that they tear down all these Confederate statues in America and in the American South. Yet at the same time, we allow this statue of this mass murderer to stand up in one of the most progressive cities in America, which seems a little odd. And I tend to agree with him on that. Okay, moving on. Todd said, the Seattle Times has been simplistic for quite some time. Remember, they sued Smiley for posting one of their headlines. I don't think they sued her, but they gave her like a cease and desist, I'm pretty sure. I'm not sure if it eventually turned into a lawsuit, but yeah, Tiffany Smiley used a Seattle Times story in one of her campaign ads, which is done a lot. It's done often. And the Seattle Times didn't want their logo on her in her campaign ad, which is like, it's just weird. I'd never heard of anything like it. Phoenix 19 says, I'm livid that a Lenin statue is even still standing in the U.S. It needs to be hauled off to the smelter. Yeah, and that's the issue, is it is up to the person who owns it and on that property to decide whether they want to remove it ultimately. But I can understand why it's very hurtful to so many people that that statue is still there. Oceana 23 says, diversity means no diversity of opinion. Precisely. I mean, that's the whole issue in Seattle. You want to say that you're tolerant and, you know, you're progressive and you're inclusive and all of these things. How tolerant has Seattle been to me? How inclusive has Seattle been to my thoughts and my ideas? I mean, of course, we have a lot of fans of the show. But, you know, when it comes to the left-wing media in Seattle, when it comes to Seattle politicians, I mean, how often do I get vilified and called right-wing? And I consider myself to be a moderate. There is nothing, no opinion that will be allowed outside of the progressive echo chamber. I mean, I even saw an article the other day, I think it was in The Stranger, that they called Bruce Harrell a conservative. It's like, Bruce Harrell is not a conservative, the mayor of Seattle. It's just laughable. But again, it's this othering and vilification of anyone who veers outside that progressive mindset. That's not inclusive. That's not tolerant. But again, they paint anything left of, anything right of far left as hate. It's wild. And they get away with it, by the way. Kathy said, term limits are needed. Is that in reference to Maria Cantwell?
Yes, yeah. I believe so.
Yeah, I mean, Maria Cantwell, what's interesting about her is that she ran, who is the senator? Oh my gosh, I cannot believe I'm blanking on his name, Slade Gordon. She ran and replaced Slade Gordon. And one of her campaign things at the time was that he'd been in long enough. You know, it's time for someone new. I think she's been in just as long as, can you look that up, Nicole?
Yes.
So I think she has now been in just as long as Slade Gordon was in before she replaced him. So, I mean, if it was long enough back then, isn't it long enough now? And I get it that when you're a senator and you achieve a certain level of seniority, you can be more effective for your state. But we have two senators who have been in their jobs, you know, Patty Murray, Maria Cantwell, for a particularly long time. And at least Patty Murray, I see her around. At least I see her in off years, actually out, you know, talking about issues, having press conferences. Maria Cantwell is a ghost for 5 years, and then every sixth year she comes out of hiding and pretends to care about issues. Did you figure it out?
Yes. So she's been in since 2001.
Yeah.
So 22 years. And then Slade was in from 81 to 87, so 6 years, and then 89 to 2001, so 6 years plus 12 years.
Yeah.
So, yes, she's been in longer.
Interesting, Maria. I wonder if that still stands, or is it not time for a change now? But I agree with term limits. I don't know exactly where they should be set. I think that you can have a mixture. I think, you know, 2 terms in the Senate and 3 terms in the House, I think would be fine. And you can combine the two of them, too. So you can do 2 terms in the Senate, 3 terms in the House as an individual. I think that's more than enough time. And for a governor, for the love of God, we should have term limits for the governor of our state. There's no reason one person should run the state for 12 years. You're telling me 7.5 million people, we've only got one guy who can do the job for 12 years? No. So there needs to be term limits on the governor's office for sure.
Is that to make that happen, you'd have to get all of these people that don't want term limits to bring it, right?
So yes.
Yikes.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and I understand.
As a country, I think people would support this. Everybody yes. except for the people that represent us would support that.
Well, that's the thing is, in Washington state, and this is why they didn't want to put checks on the governor's emergency mm-hmm. power during the pandemic. They're like, why would we? We're right. in control of the House and Senate. That's not going to change. They don't foresee that changing in Washington state for Democrats. And we've had the governor's office for 40 years. Mm-hmm. Why would we put checks and balances on a governor of our own political party? Because they can't see outside that. They cannot see outside the party structure to see why that benefits the people they serve more, and also why it's closer to what our form of government is supposed to be, with the power closest to the people. And even though I don't particularly like the job that our state reps and senators are doing, not all of them, obviously, but the party in power for sure, they are still a more direct reflection of their of the people of their district than the governor is. So it's just disappointing. But again, not a surprise. Okay, mm-hmm. let's see here. On Maria Cantwell, Elle says, spot on, we need changes done and fast. Identify the root cause, which we all know what it is, and start making changes to fix it. Clearly what has been done is far from working. Yeah, and you're just going to sit around a table with a dozen people and wax poetic about all the things the federal government could do, should do to improve the situation in Washington state? No, suck it up and do what needs to be done. You're not, people aren't going to like it, a far fringe politically, but I will promise you, a majority of Washingtonians will like the outcome. They will like what they see happening on the streets if you start to actually enforce the laws that we have on the books around substance use. If you make it easier for police to actually hold people accountable for selling drugs, for abusing drugs in the open, and for trafficking drugs through our state. I bet you 95% of people would be happy with the outcome of that.
Did you say Chief Diaz was there too?
I don't think so. Did I?
There was a law enforcement representative, right?
Well, there was Robert Hammer with Department of Homeland Security was there.
But none of, Hammer didn't bring that up? Oh, we got to get him on.
We've had him on before.
Yeah. Hammer didn't bring that up, saying, Well, let's get him on.
In his defense, a little bit. I mean, that's not his purview.
Right, and it's not a great, I mean, that's not a comfortable environment.
Well, it doesn't matter. I think there's a million people who would have been at that table and would have said, we have to make sure that there's a punishment for it.
Yeah.
We have to enforce the freaking law.
Or just acknowledge the problem and say, hey, we're seeing it come up here and we think that it might be due to this. Like, they've talked to people who say that's why they came here.
Right. And again, I'm not saying that those other things aren't a factor. I'm not saying the I-5 corridor isn't a factor. I'm not saying that availability of beds, whatever, isn't a factor. But we wouldn't even need, like, bed availability and treatment availability if the problem weren't so bad.
And you're not going to change the I-5 corridor.
No, we just move the road.
Let's work on something we can fix.
But I go back to, and I said this over and over during the whole police pursuit debate. If I'm a cartel leader, right? I don't know why I'm going like this. If I'm a cartel leader.
Imagine.
And I'm like, what state is the least risky for me to traffic mm-hmm. drugs through? And what state is the most profitable? I'm going to go where the addicts are. I'm going to go to a place where my little low-level dealers that trickle down to my organization aren't going to be arrested, where the drug markets aren't going to be disrupted. In fact, where it can happen out in broad daylight in downtown, the heart mm-hmm. of a city, and nothing's going to happen. So you're going to do that, and then you're going to say, okay, my middlemen, my traffickers, my guys who are driving the drugs up the border from one state to another, where would they be least likely to be caught? And they don't care about the traffickers. They care about their supply, right? Sure. Where am I least likely to lose my supply? What other state other than Washington state
where they passed a law
that made it almost impossible mm-hmm. for police to pursue a vehicle? So if you're a trafficker of drugs, then you're going to police come up behind you. Well, bye. See mm-hmm. you later. We've already, and you people would act like, oh, well, criminals don't know the laws. Are you kidding me? You don't think that the cartel know every single aspect of the laws that are on the books mm-hmm. in the states that they traffic drugs through? It's absurd. Why aren't we doing these jobs? Listen, we need to be like in charge of these issues. And so do all of our listeners and viewers. It's so, but that's the thing is, I don't think that we're just complaining about the job that they're doing. We're telling them, we're spelling it out to you. This is clearly what's going on. These are clearly the things that differentiate our state. And if you can't see that, you don't belong within 100 feet of elected office. Mm-hmm. Absolutely absurd. Yeah. On Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal in the congressional hearing, Two Ladies Midwest Adventure says many of these questions were sent prior, which was not answered. I don't get it.
So I think what she's saying is, because I saw that a little bit differently too, is when he answered that, he said, yes, I'll bring him. But he already knew that was going to be a question and he didn't have a good enough answer. That I think that's where Jordan was going and saying, hey, wait, are you like, you had this before. Why have you still not answered it? And saying, you know, are you holding them in wherever? Mm-hmm. I mean, not every single person, but where's the general area you take these people?
Yeah, right? He could have said so that, terrorist, but I don't but expect him to go through. And it might be a lot of different answers.
I don't think anybody expects him to go through all of them. But, I mean, have some sort of answer going in. And I think he was just pushing him on that a little bit. And Jayapal, like, why did you, I mean, he would have just stopped and said, yeah, I'll work on that. And, I mean, she just made it into a show.
She did, yeah, because she doesn't like that topic being brought up.
Right.
Nobody, no American wants to hear that there's terrorists coming up through the southern border, right? That's not popular.
Some of them are just, you know, they're getting away.
Yeah. Worthless congressional hearings. Well, yeah, think of that. 140 on the terror watch list who have come up through the border, and those are the ones we know about.
Right.
That's terrifying to think of how many we don't know about.
Exactly.
It's a political issue. Oh, it's a humanitarian crisis. It is in some areas, but in other areas, it's a drug cartel issue and a terrorist issue. Mm-hmm. On aliens, Bob says, quote, non-human operators, which is really scary. That's what the whistleblower said. Non-human. Well, that could be robots. Non-human operators. It doesn't have to be.
But it said biological.
Didn't.
Yeah, they said biological.
Can you pull that clip back up?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Nicole.
Take me off camera here for a second.
All right, because now I want to listen to it again. We've got time.
If you believe we have crashed craft, stated earlier, do we have the bodies of the pilots who piloted this craft?
As I've stated publicly already in my News Nation interview, biologics came with some of these recoveries. Yeah.
Biologics.
Okay.
Were they, I guess, human or non-human biologics?
Non-human, and that was the assessment of people with direct knowledge on the program I talked to that are currently still on the program. And
I take that as biologic.
You're right. You're right.
Biological material,
like a little alien all crashed.
Well, let's hope they're dead.
Well, if you've ever watched, what is the show with the? Independence Day. Mm-hmm. They think he's dead, and the alien comes out of its own head and comes back to life.
Yes,
this is
terrifying.
A very serious news program. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate it. We'll have to have an update on that. Mm-hmm. Okay, we should also we'll talk about Summer Freedom Fest after Sanity Check.
Okay.
How does it sound? If you want to come back on, we'll talk about that. Let us get to our closing Sanity Check, shall we? I warned you guys on the show earlier this week that concerned parents are the next group that's going to be targeted by far-left extremists during the 2024 election. And what I mean by that is, you know, it's so easy to throw labels and try to vilify and try to scare. You know, we're seeing that with Dave Reichert right now, who's a moderate Republican. Nice guy if you take 5 minutes to sit and chat with him. Not a bomb thrower. Yet the first chance they got, the state Democratic Party is like, he's right-wing. He's a MAGA Trump supporter, because they know that if they can vilify, if they can other, if they can use scary labels and scary terms, then people are less likely to listen to someone like Dave's actual ideas about how to solve the problems that Democrats in the state have created. And I warned you guys on Monday that concerned parents are now the group that is being vilified and being labeled because they have so many legitimate concerns that I think really could turn the tide as far as the electorate goes in Washington state. And so when you have Democrats who see that, they're like, okay, what can we do to not necessarily shut them up, but to make people less likely to listen to them? And I was just so disappointed with this Danny Westneed op-ed in the Seattle Times. This is like, I should have titled this episode, Why the Seattle Times is Letting Me Down. Because I like a lot of what Danny does, but he talked about Referendum 101. He said, with referendum failure, Washington just dodged a bullet of hype and hate. He said, when the former president's toxic son, Donald Trump Jr., started weighing in on Washington state politics in April, I admit it put me a little on edge. It had the potential to poison politics in our state for the entire year. And he quoted Trump Jr. saying, these sick bastards are evil. Washington passes bill allowing the state to take children away from parents that do not consent to their child's gender transition surgeries. Danny said, it didn't matter that the tweet was false. It got 3 million views anyway. It seemed to herald that the culture war over trans youth, so prevalent around the country, would soon be raging here. And then he gets into the whole debate around 55-99. But again, I think what is missing. And this almost ties back into our first story about how there is this real lack of nuance. And the media is guilty of this as well. Either things are black or white. Either this referendum 101 to overturn Senate Bill 5599 was an exercise in hate and bigotry, or as some people would say, it's about, you know, saving trans kids, where there's a lot of nuance in the middle of that. But if the media is not even willing to have nuanced conversations, why would everyone else have nuanced conversations? A lot of people rely on, or used to rely on, the media to inform them about an issue so they can talk about it amongst themselves, so they can form their opinion on how they feel about it. They relied on the media to give them facts that they could digest, and then they could come up with an answer, how they wanted to vote, etc. But when you have a headline, you know, calling a referendum a bullet of hype and hate, and I know it's an op-ed, but at the same time, there are so many legitimate arguments against 5599 that have nothing to do with hatred, that have nothing to do with transgender issues. But we cannot have those conversations because not even the media will allow those conversations to happen. No one wants to have conversations around nuance. So again, when we talk about the insanity that is about to ensue over the next year leading up to the 2024 election, so much of it is going to be hyper-focused on parents who dare raise concerns about their rights being taken away, their rights to consent to child's medical care, their rights as parents to know what's happening within their child's schools. And so I just, again, want to gear you up for that and for you to sit and think and take some time to wonder, how am I going to respond to that when people try to vilify me, when people try to label me, when people come after me with insane headlines saying I supported a bullet of hype and hate? How am I going to respond to that? Am I going to shrivel back? Am I going to stay silent? Am I going to shut up? Or am I going to double down? And am I going to force the media to use nuance when they talk about these issues? So just keep that in mind. That has been your sanity check for today. And that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. This weekend, we want to make sure we remind you every single day, we're going to be at the Summer Freedom Fest. This is the first annual Summer Freedom Fest. We deserve this. We love summer. We love freedom. If you're interested in going, it's 4 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Willowcrest Stables in Redmond. Dave Reichert is going to be there. Sammy Byrd is going to be there. So you can hear from two candidates for governor. Raul Garcia, a candidate for U.S. Senate, is going to be there. It's hosted by Brian Haywood. I am going to be emceeing the event alongside our friend John Carlson from KVI. And in addition to you being able to go, there's food trucks. There's going to be live music, so bring a chair and an umbrella or a blanket to hang out in. There's also going to be an opportunity for you to sign six really common sense initiatives. I think if you like one of them, you're probably going to like them all. They're being put forth by Brian Haywood and letsgowaw.com. And I'll just name a couple of them that are going to be there: to repeal the tax on capital gains, to make the long-term care tax optional, to repeal the carbon tax, which is leading to the higher prices at the pump. Also, there's one to put the police pursuit law back the way it was pre-2021, which is, we know, something that has bipartisan support. So you can come there, good music, food, us, which is a huge benefit, undivided swag for sale, bring cash though, undivided, undivided swag for sale, and also you can help save the state of Washington. So why would you not be there? We're planning, again, we're planning your Saturday for you. So Willowcrest Stables, Redmond, 4 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Be there or be square. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We'll be back on the live show tomorrow. But in the meantime, if you've not become a subscriber already, please do so. Help support our mission and our movement to return common sense and sanity to our conversations around news and politics. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. Woo-hoo!